I really do feel incredibly grateful to this community for the opportunity to do what I get to do. Like you all are the people that make that possible, and in a way that means that I don't have to do quite as many other income generating things. You know, this is part of that, and so I appreciate it. I feel really grateful, and I don't think I ever feel that more acutely than when we're on vacation, which is kind of interesting. Maybe that falls under absence makes the heart grow fonder. I'm not sure how that works exactly. What I do know from my experience is that the people of this community, that your stories and your concerns and your joys are just, they're just never very far from my mind and my heart. And so in some ways, I sort of take you with me on vacation. I'm grateful for that because I'm grateful for that because it shapes the way I look at the world, you know, and in ways that are positive. I'm also grateful that when I do go on vacation, I'm not trying to get away in some negative sense. It's true that I need time to rejuvenate and reconnect with my family in a different setting. That's also the case. That doesn't feel like an escape from something negative, which I'm so grateful for. It's a lovely space to be in. And so in a lot of ways, that's at the core of my practice of trying to bring something meaningful back to this group of people when I'm away. This is sort of my version of, you know, my parents went to Disneyland and all I got was this stupid t-shirt. This is the t-shirt. I hope it's not stupid. I can't claim that one size will fits all, but this is me trying to bring something back, you know, for all of us. So this year, we had sort of a mixed agenda for our family travels. Corrine has two siblings in BC. And, I mean, their dad passed away in January. And so we had his interment here at the end of May, just shortly before we left. But not all the family members were able to be here. And so there was an opportunity to connect with family while we were out there. And as it turned out, her oldest sibling and only brother became a grandparent during that same time. So first grandchild. In that part of the, you know, that kind of among the siblings. And so there was this new baby to meet, which meant that Corrine had a vacation on steroids, because as any of you who've been around Corrine and babies know, that's just how that works. And we also went to revisit some favorite mountain biking climbing haunts with just Tyrion and Taya along. And that was interesting because, first of all, traveling with four people instead of six people is different. Two less bikes, you know, if you're the guy who's taking care of the bikes, that's different. So that was great. And also because both those kids have really kind of come into their own as athletes in the last few years. They're just at that stage where the horsepower is really kicking in. And so that was really fun to, especially Taya, who last time we were in some of these places, she was a little kid. You know, we were taking her places that, you know, would make you go, and she has some scars to prove it. But this time, she just nailed stuff. And so it was a really cool experience for everybody, I think. You know, so that was really neat. So we were pretty, that was our plan. And we were pretty stoked about the plan. I'm not going to trouble you with all the details and stories and photos. Because that'd just be, you know, imposing. But There was one location on this trip that felt like it had something unique to say to me about the community at the table. We stopped and rode at a couple of favorite places in the Kootenai Range, and then we kept going all the way to Whistler. How many of you have been to Whistler? Okay. Whistler's kind of an interesting place. It's sort of this like super polished up mountain resort village. It was built in the mid-60s, like before 1964, there was no Whistler, which once you go there and see what's there now, it's a little staggering, but it was built as part of an unsuccessful bid for the Olympics, which, you know, they didn't get the Winter Olympics till 2010, right? I think it was the year that they had the Winter Olympics. Anyway, so it took a while, but so there's basically like this, build it from scratch, make it high-end mountain village at Whistler. And it's got lots of restaurants and lots of hotels and lots of gifty kind of places. It's not really our kind of place as a family in lots of ways, but it is also situated in the midst of some truly spectacular mountains. and has very ready access to backcountry. And so we kind of, it's kind of like going to Vegas to go rock climbing, which is a fairly common thing for Winnipeggers to do, right? You stay in Vegas and you know, Red Rocks is like just over the, it's 40 minutes out of town. So you can eat at the buffet and then, you know, so you get this kind of combination of dirt bag, not dirt bag thing going on. So we sort of base camp in Whistler and then get out there. And Squamish is just down the road, and the climbing in Squamish is great. So that's kind of how that works. So we spent some time in Whistler. In the mid-50s, so when there was no Whistler, the way we think of it now, all that was there was this little logging town at Alta Lake, which is right in the area. And there's a train track, still a train track, that runs all the way up the valley. And in 1956, there was a train wreck just outside of what's now Whistler. And what happened is that when they were loading up the train, which was a four-engine train, mostly filled with lumber, they miscalculated the weight of the train. And so there's a long climb in another area nearby up to an area called Green Lake. And so when they got to that climb, they couldn't do it. And so they actually had to split the train in half and climb, do the climb twice to get everything to the top, right? So they were behind schedule. Any Johnny Cash fans in the room? The wreck of the old 97? Anyway, a story about a train that got going too fast because it was behind schedule. This is sort of that story. So when they get the engines back on the whole train, they're trying to make up time. And when they get to this narrow section of track just outside of Whistler, they are, the tape and the engine says, they were going more than twice the speed that they were supposed to be going for that section of track. And so one of the engines skipped the track and it had a train derailment, and a bunch of cars got lodged in this narrow part, this narrow gap in the mountain. They just got stuck in there because they went off the tracks, right? And the company that owned the rail line didn't have the equipment to get the train cars out of the, get them unstuck. So they called some local loggers who brought some heavy machinery, hooked onto these train cars, pulled them out of the gap, and basically dragged them off into the old growth forest and just like shoved them out of the way, just shoved them off in the bush, left them there. So that collection of abandoned train cars, which is still there, is now known simply as the train wreck. And until that whole story that I just told you came out fairly recently, it was a bit of a mystery how these train cars got to where they are, because everybody knew there was a train wreck. They knew it was in the 50s. They knew that's what the cars were from. But when you walk into that forest, there's no evidence of how the train cars got from where the track is, which is up on the embankment, to where the train cars are, which is down by the river. Like, there's no bashed up trees. There's no, it looks like they fell out of the sky, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So until this story came out, that was a bit of a mystery. And the other thing that makes this kind of interesting is that the locals knew where to find the train, the wrecked cars, but there was no clear, singular sort of trail to them. So you kind of had to be a local to know where this thing was and to find it. It was just shoved off in the forest somewhere. And so what happened as a result is that it became sort of a hangout. And the mountain bikers found it, and they made like ramps off the top of the train cars and, you know, did the things that they do, and the graffiti community found it and decided, this is interesting, Jeremy, we'll keep going down this path, so stay with me, but the graffiti community found it and decided it would be the perfect canvas for their work, because you don't get away with that in downtown Whistler, baby. Like, it gets kept polished, right? More on that as well. And so in some ways, this train wreck kind of became the antithesis of the ism that is Whistler. You could think of it this way. It's quite close. Like, you could walk there from Whistler if you were just sort of feeling like a decent walk. It's kind of on the fringes of Empire. It really is. Like, when you're in Whistler, you are up to your eyebrows in upper middle class big money recreation. And skiing is not for the poor. It's not a polished place. The train wreck is kind of dangerous, it's kind of unstable, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. It's on the margins of the thing that we think of if we think about what Whistler is. And things and people, ideas, places that are on the margin intrigue me. And one of the reasons that things that are on the margin intrigue me is because I'm curious about who else is drawn to them. Who else feels like the prevailing norms aren't a great fit? Who else wants or needs to get away? Who else wants to make something alternative? Who else wants to make something that creatively critiques the mainstream? What does that have to do with the table? Well, I want to show you a couple of pictures of the place, one of which I hope will help us to muse about that question. But this is, I mean, it's really bright in here, but just to give you some idea. So you can kind of see this. Go ahead, Michael, you can just kind of scroll through these. I mean, they're just in the middle of this, like how did that get there, right? Surrounded by these enormous trees that are way older than the wreckage. Despite the fact that the light level in here is such that you can't see how vivid the colors are, it's kind of remarkable. So just pause right there for a second. So that's just out of interest. So Kale and Taya and Kareen are on top of this train car. And in the foreground is the landing ramp from a bike jump, the takeoff ramp of which is just in front of where Kale's standing. So there's this enormous gap in between. Keep going, because I think the next photograph, I don't think we'll be able to read it. What it says in blue paint on there, that's the launch ramp. So that's looking at it from the other vantage point down to the forest. What it says is send it or die on the ramp. Anyway, keep going. Interesting graffiti in this place. Some of it's quite elaborate. Those are both inside train cars. But there was one in particular that stopped my traffic. This is it. It's hard to read in this slide, so the next slide shows it closer up. So just put the next one up, Michael, and then just leave it up, okay? One more, yeah. It says, this is my church. This is where I heal my hurts. So, who comes to a train wreck for healing, right? What's wrong? What's wrong with the Church of Whistler anyway? Like, why not go there for healing? Because it's beautiful, and it's well resourced, and it's got everything you need, and much, much, much more. So I don't know, of course, the names and addresses of who goes to this particular train wreck seeking healing. Someone does. And I would say, looking around at the thousands of hours of passionate work that have been poured into the art and the ramps, and I would say there's quite a few people that do. But having said that I don't know the particulars, humor me. Just for a bit, I want to speculate about what might characterize the folks that would look for healing in a train wreck, because I think that there might be some insight in that question for us as a community. I think it's a reasonable speculation that the people who look for healing at the Whistler train wreck are the people that don't feel at home in Whistler. Right? That kind of makes sense? I mean, why wouldn't those people feel at home in Whistler? Well, that could cover a lot of ground. We could begin with the observation that Whistler is on First Nations land. In recent years, that township, that municipality, has made quite an effort to acknowledge that through signage. There's a lovely new Aboriginal art gallery in Whistler and a museum. But when you walk around town, most of the faces look a lot like mine. They're looking younger and hipper and richer and leaner, but they're pretty white. It's a pretty Anglo town. If you want to see how the living conditions for most of the First Nations in the area these days are, you just need to drive up the valley toward Pemberton, which we also did. I'm not going to elaborate, except I'm just going to say it's nothing like Whistler. In fact, it's more like the train wreck. It's kind of rough at the edges and shoved off to the side. So if I was from the not prevailing culture of this area, and I was looking for a space that felt like I could make it my own, I might find that train wreck kind of appealing. Or perhaps I'm someone that just needs a bit more space. I just need a bit more room to move. Maybe I need to not be in a place where I'm constantly surrounded by high density people and programming and money and power. Maybe that's just not my thing. In fact, maybe being surrounded by that environment makes me kind of twitchy. Or maybe it actually makes me feel ill. Makes me feel kind of sick. But the silence of those abandoned ghostly cars, you know, dropped in the middle of this old growth forest, surrounded by towering cedars, often as not in this climate, shrouded in mist and rain. I could breathe there. I could breathe there. Or maybe I'm someone that needs shelter. And in a place on the margins, I can find shelter without having to give up my dignity. Which is not to suggest that all the places that offer shelter in the prevailing culture require giving up your dignity. That is not my point. I didn't take a picture of this. It felt too personal to me. I'd make a horrible photojournalist. I'd back off at all the wrong moments. But in the end of one of these cars, one of the relatively intact cars, there was a quilt. And it looked like in its day it had been a pretty nice one. It wasn't a, you know, it wasn't a thrift shop quilt. It was a nice quilt. And I couldn't help. Still can't, apparently. Couldn't help but imagine the story, right? How'd that get there? Who wrapped that around their shoulders in Whistler? Where the people who can afford that quilt live and got out of town and ended up in that train car? Who did that? Why'd they do that? Who headed for the train car? Who headed for the wreckage, looking to heal their hurts? I could keep going, but maybe that can stir our imaginations a little. I hope, among other things, it can stir our imaginations about this community, not least of all because from another vantage point, the table has a fair bit of kinship with that train wreck. Yes! Who's hugging me? So good. We're not particularly polished. We are not supposed to agree with me. No, it's all good. It's true, right? Yeah. We're not, in relative terms, a community with a lot of wealth or power. I added the relative terms very consciously. We don't have a home. And these days, you know, we're struggling to pay for the temporary spaces we're in. But we've got some room to breathe. We make some silence every time we're together. We might not make a lot in a given morning. I think we could probably use some more, but we always make some. We're not exactly theologically firing up the middle. In fact, we don't exist to perpetuate any particular theology. We exist to make room for the exploration of belief. At our best, folks, at our best, I think we're sort of like those abandoned boxcars. We are a place of potential shelter. We are a place that can provide a canvas for the expression of ideas, images, beliefs, struggles, life experiences, questions, ones that might not fit in a more polished, kind of tidied up environment. They need a home, those things. You might not know this about our history as a community, but we have been shuffled off to the side by the established church on more than one occasion. I say this without regret or rancor. I really do. I think it's just, it's been messy sometimes. The wreckage isn't necessarily pretty, but I think it's been a very natural part of us trying to find our place. And the fact that it is messy and sometimes it isn't pretty does not mean that the resulting community isn't a very, very special one, and one that is just right for the people that are drawn to it. One final thought about finding healing in a train wreck. Here at the table, the vantage point for our exploration of belief tends to focus on Christian spirituality, not least of all because that's the mother tongue for most of us in the community. That's the language with which the majority of us access spiritual conversation. That's interesting to me because that story, the Jesus story from which Christianity emerged, is also a story that comes into the stream of history from the margins. The Christian religion has had quite a run of power the last few hundred years. It's easy to forget that the last few hundred years is a blip on the radar of human history. That's a very short segment of time. It's also easy to forget that as we have it, the story of the person and the teachings of Jesus took place not only on the margins of the prevailing culture of the day, kind of the fringes of the empire, but also on the margins of the subculture of the day. Jesus is not a mainstream Hebrew character. Jesus self-describes in the Gospels as someone that has no place to lay their head. No fixed address. Now, for us, no fixed address means you can't get a driver's license. No fixed address in that culture did not necessarily mean that. It means something different. It's still a very interesting value for the lead character in the Jesus story to use as a self-description. And when Jesus says to the people, "You have heard it said," he is making a very clear observation about the prevailing norms. "You have heard it said" is shorthand for "the prevailing culture says." The tagline to "You have heard it said" is "but I say." And then Jesus proceeds to screw with the system like every time. They got him killed. He definitely operated from the margin. And it got him killed in a way that was meant to permanently keep him on the margin. History would say that that is not how the story's gone. But that's... The Romans chose the execution method they did because it was so effective in continuing to keep the people they wanted on the margins, on the margins. It said, don't gun for the center, because if you gun for the center, you'll end up on a shame stick in the town square. Or if not in the town square, on an easily observed vantage point, so no one can miss the message. This story comes from the margins, people. And it's a story if it's not welcoming the margins, somehow we've lost the point. I think the story in which the most common spiritual language in this community stands unfolds in a way that welcomes the people that might not feel at home in the middle of whatever the big deal is. I think this is a story that is meant, and I hope a community that can continue to welcome people that need some room to move, some room to paint outside of the lines, to make something with unfamiliar contours, something risky. People that need to huddle in the corner for a while, just put the quilt around your shoulder and be still. People that need to push back on the norms, people that get twitchy when they're told to stand in line. People that could stumble across a train wreck or a train wreck of a church and think, this is the kind of place where I might be able to heal some hurts.